And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Messi on Spence, trying to find space for that left foot into the middle. Enzo Fernandez! Argentina, they always find a way, and they've tied the game! Enzo Fernandez, the goal scorer. Gonzalez in for Alexis McAllister off the post, second time today. And Spence beats Messi to the loose ball.
Still in.
Spence might be hurt. Messi resets. Messi driving in. Messi crossing back. Post, there it is. Lautaro Martinez. Stoppage time. Go ahead goal for Argentina.
From the heart of Queens to the ears of sports fans everywhere, this is Sports Kings from Queens. Strap in because the Kings are in session. Today's Wednesday, July 15th. This is episode 244. I'm Gino, joined by my co-hosts, Kevin and Darren. Please catch us wherever you get your podcast. Make sure to like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Give us a look, join our pages. We'd love to hear from you. Feel free to leave your questions, comments. We'll respond. We'll get back to you. Tonight, we go around the world of sports. We're going to get it started with the World Cup. We have our finalists for Sunday's final, Spain versus Argentina. Let's talk about how we got here, Kev.
Yeah, Spain side, you know, a lot less controversy than on the Argentina side. So let's recap those games real quick. Started off, France beat Morocco 2-0 in the quarterfinals. Mbappe misses the penalty kick in the 28th minute. Bono made the save. That's his fourth World Cup penalty save, which is the most in 66 for a goalie. So, you know, the Moroccan goalie played great. Mbappe finally broke through in the 60th. Dembele in the 66th. I mean, some of the stats were pretty even, but France dominated. The expected goals, 3.69 for France. So they blew chances all over the place. Morocco expected goals, 0.14. I don't think I've ever seen a number that low.
They never really tried to push. They couldn't figure out how to penetrate the France defense, and it was pretty obvious.
Yeah, France dictated the tempo for almost the whole game. Morocco never found the rhythm. They couldn't get into any space they needed to make any kind of comeback. So go ahead, Kev.
Shots were 22-5, including 8-1 on goal. I mean, the fact that, you know, Bono had to make six saves against France. I mean, terrific. And, you know, France was just outclassed Morocco.
And up to that point, France looked like the team that really hadn't skipped a beat at any moment in this tournament. They looked like the offense was never going to be able to be controlled, and the defense was solid enough. I mean, not like Spain, where they hadn't yielded a goal at that point, you know, but it looked like France had done a lot of real major things. It looked like the most dominant team in the tournament to me, especially after the Morocco game.
And then you mentioned Spain and goalless streak, I guess, or not allowing goal streak. That finally ended against Belgium. They did pull out the 2-1 win. Ruiz scored in the 30th minute for Spain. De Ketelaere for Belgium. 41st minute, finally, the first goal allowed by Spain this entire tournament. I mean, the run they were on defensively was incredible.
His headers off set pieces have been unbelievable. You saw what he did to the United States. I mean, I'm just saying.
I mean, he had two against the U.S.
Yeah,
he's just that one against Spain.
And he overran the Spain kid, not as bad as he did Ream, where it looked like he was beating the crap out of him, but he kind of bullied the Spain kid too. I can't remember who it was, but he knocked him. He kind of shoved him into the net almost as well.
Yep. In the second half, and then the big blow for Belgium was when their goalie Courtois got injured and was replaced by Lammens in the 71st minute.
Yeah, that was the whole thing, Kev. Lammens in his third cap, you know, coming in, hadn't played a competitive game since May.
Yeah.
He comes in and kind of leaves a fat rebound right there. It's a ball he's got to be able to control, and you feel like Courtois is going to control that. Yeah. And because Spain's the better team in this match, but the Red Devils are hanging around for Belgium. They're keeping it close. They're keeping it competitive. They score the equalizer. They're annoying them. They're keeping Spain off balance, and then that goalie switch right after the second hydration break.
Yep.
And not that Lammens was bad, but you know that's a bad rebound he let up, and then you know Belgium really didn't have an answer to it, Kev.
I think the big play before the goalie, or I think right after the goalie switch, De Bruyne had one from about 40 yards and had a wide open net, and Rodri was able to get back and get in the way of the shot, and looked like Belgium was going to take the lead there.
Yeah, it was just a poor. They had an opportunity to kind of move the ball there a little bit, I thought, and get a cleaner shot than what De Bruyne was trying to do from. Midfield, but he was further back, and I thought that they could have tried to pass it up, but I understand what he was trying to do. But great reaction, though. I agree.
Yep. And then Marino, about half a minute after he came in, or a minute and a half after he came in as a sub, scores in the 88th minute, like you said, off a fat rebound.
Yeah. Second straight game scoring as a sub. I mean, he's been super sub in this tournament.
Yep. And then that set up the semifinal matchup, Spain-France, and wow, did Spain put on a masterclass. They dominated, and they just really squeezed the life out of the French attack.
You know, it was funny. I mean, the first time I've seen France the entire tournament not without space.
Yeah.
Spain, it's because we get to this level now, and we'll talk about the other side as well. But now all the teams are equal, right? So you're sitting there watching – France isn't just outclassing a Morocco team that's going to try to play a specific style, and they're not outclassing somebody like that. And Spain isn't doing the same thing. Now, both of these teams have speed, but we're used to watching Mbappe, even in his regular season, you know, always seemed like he had space. And in this, he had a couple opportunities, missed a free kick, a couple of things. But Spain was the better team, Kev.
Oh, all game.
And the goal, the second goal was one of the prettiest goals I've seen all tournament. That was amazing, that second goal. Sorry, G.
So before that game, France had outscored opponents 16-2 entering that game. I mean, 16-2. And in that game, they don't find the rhythm at all. I mean, France just stifles them the whole game. Go ahead, Kev.
You know, they got the early goal, 22nd minute. You know, Digne fouled Yamal. You know, it was very
I hate that call. He blocks on his body. He's going to kick it. The guy runs into him, and he kicks him. I know it's a penalty.
It's a penalty.
I hate the call because what's he supposed to do? He knows this guy's sneaking around while he blocks him with his body and tries to wind and kick. Thing about soccer penalties that makes this sport where you're like, will it ever be a dominant sport in the United States is the BS that goes on. We know the NBA has BS, and we know the NFL has BS, and we know MLB has this, and we know the NHL. But soccer blows them all away. It's the one referee, the confusion all over the place, VA Argentina, as we'll call them in a little bit. I mean, you know, there's a lot happening. And I know it's the call. It was almost like, remember that play where the Bengal not hit Mahomes late?
Yeah,
it's a penalty. But you don't want to see it called there because it's stupid. I know by the letter of the law, it's a penalty because he's being reckless with his left leg. He blocks the ball with his body. He goes to turn to kick it. What's he supposed to do? Just let it sit there because that guy snuck up on him? I don't know, man. It drove me nuts. Anyway, I'm sorry, Kev.
It was a very unfortunate penalty.
It's horrible.
On Digne because, you know, it's not like he did anything intentional on purpose. Oh. It was purely accidental. You can't kill the guy for that type of penalty.
I root for Spain too, by the way. So I don't root for France in anything. So I was rooting for Spain, but nonetheless, I was like, "Well, that's a brutal." I feel bad for this kid. If they lose 1-0, I'm going to be like, "Jesus, that's awful."
Yeah. So you know the fact that it was 1-0, it's not like Spain sat back, but my goodness, that defense is just so tough to get through. Like you said, Mbappe and the rest of, Dembele, Doué. Eliso was quiet the whole match. I mean, it was just pure dominance on defense.
And you saw Yamal come out, and that was so barely offside. That could have been 3-0 easy. I didn't even – watching it a lot of times, I'm like, is he really offside? It's so close. But what a gifted play. Right after
he's 19 years old.
I'm like, my God, you see how this guy's going to be the next one. This kid's like 21 years old? My
19.
God.
He's still a teenager.
So rarely do you get a game where France's press repeatedly keeps getting broken, and that's what happened. Spain's midfield, they controlled the tempo to the point where they kept breaking France was trying to press, they kept breaking it. They kept forcing them into these sloppy passes, these sloppy touches, which basically nobody does to France. And this is, and then, and we'll talk about it, but you could tell then as the game progressed deeper into the second half, the frustration from France started showing more and more. You could tell, right? They got those late yellow cards. They kept missing opportunities. Yeah. Mbappe, you know, he had that completely off target free kick. Like
They needed Tillman there.
Yeah, it just as that game kept going, you could just tell. You know what I mean? They kept getting more and more frustrated because no one basically does that to France, and Spain was doing it with like no problem.
Spain has the same speed as France, and it became obvious. And the only other team with the speed to match up with both of them is Argentina, and we'll talk about them next. But I mean, I'm just saying that it was, it was a masterclass of a matchup. It really was. France tried to come on, but they had an open net. They couldn't get the shot off right. They had a bunch of things that just didn't go right for them late.
You want
to see this side of the
game? Yep.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about the second goal?
This is pretty a goal as I've ever seen.
That little give and go. it was a great little give and go. I loved it, man.
And then the shot up high to the short side where the goalie could do nothing. I mean, Yamal making the pass and the fit. It was pretty. It was really, really pretty. It was like the playing the little triangle. It was the Ted Lasso triangle. Boom, boom. It was great. And it's obviously not the Ted Lasso triangle. It's the Dutch if you watch the series or if you follow soccer. But
all right, Kev. And then we get to the other side.
Boy, England, Norway. 104 degree heat index on the field in Miami at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. What a time to start the game. And
one of the three games that deserve the hydration break. The other ones are just making it four quarters instead of two.
Yeah.
Instead of two halves. But anyway,
that one, I think they needed about five hydration breaks the way they played that game. I mean, the first half hour, it felt like both teams said, yeah, we're not going to do anything for the first half hour. We're going to kick the ball around and not exert ourselves. And we're going to try to save the energy for the rest of the game. And finally, Norway broke through first. They got the turnover against Kane. Kane's looking for the penalty, not called. And Sheldrup, my God, what a rocket.
Oh,
that was perfectly placed.
That was probably one of the most beautifully struck balls
perfectly
I've seen
placed.
In the World Cup. And it was a rocket right to the upper corner there of the net.
Yep.
36th minute. And then the first controversial play was right before Bellingham's goal. So we get the goal kick, gets out there. Looks like on replay that the ball touches the cable running across the field and drops straight down. Nobody calls it. Norway's saying it happened. Nobody calls it. Bellingham comes back the other way, scores it, second minute of stoppage time, and it's 1-1. And to me, you could clearly see the ball change direction on the replay.
Of course.
You need to tell me the ball chip technology can't detect that, but it can detect it glancing off a Croatian player's hair where you don't see any sort of deflection or any change in the ball pattern when Croatia disallowed a tying goal a couple of rounds ago. I mean, ridiculous that wasn't turned over.
FIFA says the connected ball technology found no evidence that the ball had actually touched the overhead wire. That's ridiculous. You see the different trajectory in the ball. It just goes down. The one thing I've come to learn about VAR and soccer in general is that I've never seen a sport where they're so heavy for the favorite every single matchup.
Yeah.
Whoever the favorite is kind of gets it. I mean, and England was the favorite. Listen, I was rooting for Norway. It didn't matter, though. I had no real dog in the fight.
No.
But that was brutal. That was a brutal way to get the tie.
You know me. They were two of my dogs in the fight here.
Mm-hmm.
And Norway looked like they had the go ahead goal in the 55th minute off the corner kick and headed in. And Holland, I mean, he's such a big guy, such a blatant two handed, arms extended shove of the defender down. again, I think you have to call that one.
I don't, because all we see in this sport is people pushing on every jump that there is, and they don't call anything. But this one, we're going to turn it around and call it back because he's bigger and stronger than the other guy. I get it, but Hollum's getting mugged the entire game. He had four guys around him. Every time he tried to move, he was getting pushed. But none of those count. But this one, we're going to go back minutes and check because of the stupid rule of VAR. Come on.
I didn't like it. I'll tell you, I didn't like it only because on every penalty, on every corner, all we see is everybody in the box pushing and shoving each other all around. You know, it's like I know what the rule says, but this is all you see is everybody tugging on each other's jerseys and pushing and shoving and grabbing each other. And now you're going to call it like I didn't agree with the call.
Back to before the corner kick to go check it after they score. I mean, come on. How many plays do we have to go back?
Well, it was on the corner kick.
What was that?
Yeah.
It was on the corner kick.
It was on the corner.
I thought it was right before the corner.
It was on the corner.
I think it's ridiculous, though. It's stupid thing. They're mugging him. He can't push back. Get out of here.
Dude, I got a question. So Bellingham scores before the half, right? So did you guys think that when Norway came out in that second half that the game like I thought they kind of changed a lot of how they were playing. Like, I think that goal kind of like changed it up a little bit for them. When it was 1-0, I think it was fun. When it was 1-1, like I was a little worried with Norway. I didn't think they had the same intensity of attack.
I thought it was a game of spurts. I thought England came out strong first 50 minutes, then Norway took over, then England took over, then Norway came back. I thought it was going back and forth. I see your point. I thought England took over in the early part of the second half.
A lot.
I just think it was a game of spurts. Because Norway looked dead the first 20 minutes. I mean, you're saying, Kev, that both teams were waiting for like that break, but England controlled it. And then all of a sudden, Norway changed tactics after the hydration.
I agree with Kev that a lot of that first half. I agree with Kev, but in the second half, I felt like once it was 1-1, Norway kind of lost a lot of their spurt for a good part of that second half. Maybe it was just me. I don't know.
I think when they got the goal disallowed, it sort of
definitely took them down a little notch there. I definitely think.
And that's again, I know you think it was the right call. I don't.
Yep. And then then that game goes to extra time. Bellingham scores early in extra time.
Yeah.
93rd minute to give England the lead. And then by the halftime of the extra time, Holland's dragging ass out there and they look shot. He was doing nothing. I mean, they had to do something to try to get fresh legs in there, see if they could get something.
They couldn't. The slowest of the final eight teams, okay? Speed-wise, watching them play, slower than Morocco, slower than Switzerland. They were the team that was most methodical and relied on the big kick and the big guy up front getting things done. And they were already the slowest team to me, and then they got even slower. Even though they're two wings of up front, the two pressing backs that kept coming forward, I thought they did a nice job in trying to set pace, but not a lot of – I mean, not a lot of offensive skill outside of Holland.
Yeah. No, it really isn't. Although I tell you, if Sheldrup develops, I mean, he's young.
Not that
Holland's old. I mean, Holland's only mid-20s. But Sheldrup is even younger. So that might give them their second goal scorer in the future.
They'll be around. They'll be around for a while. I mean, you have one of the best goal scorers in the world right now.
Yep. Yeah.
And then we go to the other game, Saturday night, Argentina, Switzerland. McAllister scores 10th minute. Argentina's up 1-0, and you just kept waiting for Argentina. Or at least I did. I kept waiting for them to just tack on, and they never did.
So did I. I kept saying to myself, okay, where's the second and third goals? Because here it comes.
Switzerland frustrated the hell out of them.
They did.
The Natty did everything they could do to stay in that game. They frustrated the hell out of Argentina. And Messi was not as much of a fan, even though somehow, some way he gets shots off that nobody else gets, everybody else gets blocked and they get through. I mean, he does, I'm sorry, Gino, he does things that, like, you're like, how the hell is he getting the shot off?
He does. Yeah. Absolutely.
But the fact of the matter was, Switzerland just kind of squeezed them a lot. And they allowed them to move it, but it was like the bend but don't break type of team. And they were countering and countering pretty well, I thought. I thought Switzerland was taking shots.
Job.
I mean, they gave they finally got through. You're a Swiss fan.
And they finally broke through 67th minute. And Doyle tied it up 1-1. And you went, wow, this is going to be a finish. And then comes the big play. Ebolo, one of Switzerland's best players there, if not the best, dribbling up the sideline. The original call, foul on Paredes. He gets shown a yellow. And all of a sudden, here comes, as Darren said it, VAR Argentina.
Now, the interesting part about this, it cannot be reviewed if they don't call it a yellow. So if the ref doesn't call it a yellow, they can't review it. Anyway, Kev, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, from Switzerland's perspective, oh, we got a yellow on Argentina. Yes. It would have been better if it was just called a foul. Because they go to the review and they realize Paredes really didn't touch Embolo, and Embolo's the one that dove.
Well, they call it mistaken identity.
Well, what do they call it?
It's simulation. He gets called for simulation and a mistaken identity.
And the mistaken identity.
Is, if somebody's diving at you, whether they touch you or not, and you happen to go and protect yourself and go down, I don't really call that simulation. The guy was running at him and taking a dive. I'm sorry. I understand when somebody just doesn't get touched and trips up. He was coming in for him, and he, you know, it's an instinct. I mean, some people are going to fall with that. Anyway.
There needs to be a way of, again, saying, yes, Paredes did not deserve a yellow because he did not touch Embolo.
Agreed.
But to overturn the yellow and then give it to Embolo. And the big deal was that he had the yellow from earlier in the game when, you know, looked like one of those, you know, NFL roughing the kicker type calls. He got the Argentinian player after the follow through on a shot and ran into him. Looked like, you know, the punter doing the pirouette there. I mean, it's a blatant yellow, the first one. And the second one to me was real. Wow. I could see overturning Paredes's, but that's a tough call to give him that second yellow there.
Basically, the referees took control of the game and said, we're going to make this 11-on-10. Now, Switzerland, who is playing a game of tactical counterattacks, can no longer do this.
And what was the time?
Striker,
Kev, what was the time at that point?
72 minutes, right?
72nd minute, yep.
So from there, this is the team that's tactically playing counterattack with Brielle and Bolo up front. And now they take away the only guy that's got kind of fighting up front for the most part. They put him a man back against a more talented team. And it's basically over. Everybody knows it's over. There's no way they're going to hold Argentina from scoring. Not that it happened easily, but, you know.
No, it took a while. I mean, Argentina kept coming wave after wave, and Switzerland kept holding them off. And you get into extra time. And you actually get into the second half of extra time before Alvarez finally puts one in the 112th minute. And then from there, you know, Switzerland was done after that goal. And Lautaro Martinez tacked on the extra one there and added time. And it was 3-1 Argentina.
VA Argentina. Listen, were they going to win? Most likely. And is it Argentina's fault? No, but the refereeing, the officiating in this sport is pathetic. Two referees. I've been saying this for like 5 years. If they could do it in hockey, why can't they do it in soccer?
I just don't get it. I still don't understand how come there can't be two referees. I really don't.
Yeah.
There's no way one man can see everything that's going on. I know you have the two assistants on the side, but they're also watching offside, and they're watching a million other things that are going on. Who the last touch? Yep. I mean, some of these things are so hard to tell by the naked eye, you know? I mean, this is not easy. How can they see everything?
I mean, you know, I think today's game, Argentina, England, especially that first half, it felt like you needed two referees because these two teams played extremely physical in the first half.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one. I mean, they were going back and forth. It was chippy early, and, you know, the Argentina still remembers the Falklands, like you said. And, you know, I mean, this point where I think was Gordon, you know, he takes the forearm in the back of the neck, goes down, no call. I mean, to me, that's a yellow card type of foul, but no, nothing called. You know, when you're 5 minutes in and Stu holding that commentary saying, my prediction is this game does not end 11-9-11. You wind up being wrong, but it just felt like that type of physical game that somebody was going to be showing a red or a couple of yellows accumulated. But it was a scoreless half. Just to show you how the game changed. First half shots, Argentina 2, England 1. The two teams combined for about 15, 20 fouls, but three shots. Much different game second half. Gordon finally puts one in 55th minute. Beautiful cross, beautiful finish. One-timed it, and it was a 1-0 England lead. And they went to defense way too early. And Argentina just started to turn up the pressure. The attack came on strong. Even before they scored, they had two different shots off posts. I mean, they were all over the place. They were attacking. England dropped back, let Argentina come to them. And finally, off a nice feed from Messi, Enzo Fernandez puts one in to tie it 1-1, 85th minute. And then in stoppage time, 92nd minute, Lautaro Martinez off another feed from Messi puts in the game winner. And Argentina pulls out the 2-1 win.
The one thing I'll say is this is the first time ever that the top four seeds all advanced to the semifinals in the World Cup. But England had been the one team that had shown the most, I don't know, warts. I know Argentina held on against Cape Verde. They dominated the game. Cape Verde made some great plays to stay in it. I know that, you dealt with the same thing with Belgium, with Spain, where, you know, they hung around type of thing. But the simple fact of the matter is that, you know, England was kind of outplayed by Mexico. I know they were down a man, but even before that, outside of the two goals in that short spurt, they really hadn't done much. The Norway game was even for a lot of it. I mean, and then I thought England just kind of took over down the stretch because of the fatigue for Norway. And then, you know, England, you know, listen, they were right there with them. And then they get into these defensive shells. And it doesn't make any sense sometimes. They have as much offensive firepower and talent as Argentina, and they don't play like it.
Yeah. So I told you the halftime was shot 2-1.
Yep.
The game ended Argentina 15, England 5. Shows you how dominant and how England sat back and let Argentina come through. And, you know, like I said, some teams will hit the post and drop their heads and say, oh, that was our chance. Not Argentina. They just keep coming and coming at you. And they've got – when you've got Messi and you've got guys who can finish like Fernandez and Martinez, you know, they
– But England was so passive that second half.
Oh, totally, yeah.
I mean, after the Gordon goal, they were playing so passive. They were sitting back so much. It was such a lack of press that it was like
they went to a 5-4-1, Darren.
It was like,
and you know, Pickford's great. I'm not trying to downplay how good Pickford is, but there's only so much you can do when it's an onslaught. He's one of the top three goalies in the world, probably goalkeepers. I'm sorry, I know I say goalie too easy, but how much do you want to put on this poor guy? I mean, he's been great the entire tournament. They all have, but it's like, my goodness. I don't get the defensive shell that they try to go in. I thought they went defense too early. I know they were down a man against Mexico. I thought they were like they tried not to counter at all and just kept clearing it and let Mexico come down. But Mexico's not Argentina.
No.
I mean, this is Argentina. This is the world champs. This is the greatest player on the planet, or at least in the top three all time, depending on I never saw Pele really play outside of the Cosmos years. And even then I was little, so how do I know? I mean, but you know, this team's not quitting in what could be his last World Cup. He's not going to let him quit. I mean, it's like, you know, you got to play for that. You got to play for that third goal. You got to make him play defense. You got to make him put them off stride a little bit. I know England's great defensively. I know they have those big guys that come in, but I don't know. The way you guys are describing, I didn't see it. Well, Gino and Kevin did watch the game. I did not. But the way you're describing it just makes me cringeworthy for England. You know,
if you were watching it, you would have been cringe. Trust me.
It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So now we get what, Kev?
So, you know, what's interesting, too, with those two late goals, Argentina has now scored 11 goals in this World Cup, 75th minute or later. That's an incredible
stat. Well, the Cape Verde matchup went back and forth for a little bit. Then you had this, and yeah, now you're right. It's pretty interesting.
Yep. So that sets up Saturday for third place, France and England.
Okay.
And Sunday for the World Cup for the trophy, Argentina and Spain. What's your prediction on the final, Argentina-Spain? Darren.
I'm going to say Argentina repeats. I'm going to say Argentina wins this game 2-1.
Gino?
My gut says that's the prediction. But Spain just locked. We just saw Spain lock up France. We saw Spain lock up everybody. I'm going Spain. 2-0 Spain. They lock them up.
Kev? I agree with you, Gino. I am firmly in agreement with you. I think Spain has shown a defense that won't sit back and allow Argentina the room, even if they are trying to push. Argentina won't find the space late like they have against other teams here. And I think Spain pulls this one out 2-1.
So we have the same score. We just have it opposite way. So I'm the lone wolf on this one. I'm going to take Argentina.
So you're 2-1 Argentina, I'm 2-1 Spain, and Gino is 2-0 Spain.
Yep.
We'll see if anyone of us are successful.
All right. Let's move over to some tennis. Kev, Wimbledon.
Wimbledon, women's side. Unfortunately, Coco Gauff lost in semis to Muchova in three sets. A 12-10 tiebreak in the third set. I mean, right to the edge and just couldn't pull it off. And then Niskova beat Kostyuk in 6-4, 6-4 to set up the all-Czech final. And Laskova in three sets wins her first Grand Slam.
Yeah, I mean, this was an interesting match. Yeah, it was interesting. Youngest player to win the Grand Slam since 2011 when her fellow countrywoman, Kvitova, won it. I was also 21 at that time. The one thing I'll say on this matchup was that this girl was cruising, right? I think she was up 5-2 in the second set. Muchova fought a 5 championship points to send it to a third set, but couldn't fight off the 6th one when she lost it at the end. First Grand Slam title, all Czech final. Listen, it would have been nice to see Coco get there. She did everything she could. But the thing about it is when Muchova comes back in the second set down 5-2 to win 7-5, you're saying to yourself, oh, the momentum's all with her. Nah, 6-3, kind of home for Nuskova to win that third set, and then that was it. Never really threatened.
Yep.
10 straight years with a different champion in Wimbledon on the women's side. Last repeat champion or double with Serena Williams, 15-16.
Wow. And on the men's side, very similar, very different. Every year is a different champion, right, Darren?
Oh, yeah. We've had the same 4 players for the last whatever. It's now Alcaraz, too, but he didn't play in this tournament. A little bit crazy on this one. I'll put it this way. We had 31 games before we had a break. Okay, 7-6, 6-7, and it was, and there wasn't a break till it was 4-3 in the third. Zverev gets 82% of his first serves in the second set and loses the set. I've never heard of that in my life.
Yeah.
He was so on point, it was ridiculous. But Sinner is starting to wear him down a little bit. It was 4 hard-fought sets. The interesting little stat, Sinner won the match in 3 hours and 47 minutes. And he's 0-9 lifetime when it's 3 hours and 50 minutes or more. So they will sit there watching the time as if like he would lose it because he falls apart when they go over that spot.
350.
I mean, Sinner is also, in one of the stats that you'll never believe, has had held 87 consecutive service games versus Zverev. 87 straight. Last time he was broken by Zverev was during the finals of the Erste Bank Open in Vienna in October of 25. Sinner does not lose a game, a service game to this guy. You know, just one of those things where it was just great offensive tennis, if there's a better way to put it. Each guy's throwing their first serves in. I mean, Zverev, much more effective in the first two sets, seemed to wear down a little bit. Sinner was just very – he played really well. I mean, you know, Jannik Sinner without Alcaraz, you expect him to win this. A one versus two, the odds were pretty high for a one versus two, G. Usually it's expected to be close. All the money was on Sinner. Just one of those things. And he proved it to be right. Kev?
Yep. So he's got five Grand Slams now.
He does. He's Alcaraz will be back at some point, so we'll get to see that matchup again.
Yep. Two behind Alcaraz, who's got seven. And then, you know, it's amazing. 20 years, only eight of the guys won the single tournament between the big three. These two, and if you want to throw Wawrinka and Murray, who got three each,
Didn't Medvedev get one once?
Medvedev got one.
Yeah,
Team got one. Zverev got the last one at the French. Yep. You know, but nobody's got more than one except for these handful of guys.
Exactly, and Sinner and Alcaraz are so young. You know, it's going to be interesting to see if anybody's able to come up and rise up against these guys. Again, tennis is not a sport that I follow outside the majors, but the U.S. Open is coming up. That always makes it really interesting for me. Gino will have bets on it, even though he doesn't watch it much, but Gino will cover the board for all of us.
All right.
All right. So we'll move over to a little golf. This week coming up, the 154th Open, British Open. For the 11th time, we'll be at Royal Birkdale in Southport, England. First time since 2017. The winner will hoist the claret jug. Kev, Darren, any info?
Kick off with Kev. Kev. Yeah.
Well, you know, all the weather forecast you hear is that this is going to be a firm, fast course. Some of the rough is actually burned off a little bit too, which is one of the challenges that's eliminated with the rough not being as bad. So now you got to have the idea of either the accurate players are going to play in the middle and get some good bounces and get some good distance just from being in the fairway. And some of the bombers can sit there and take a chance and try to bomb it. And if you get in the rough, it's not going to be as penal as it normally is out there. You know, it's not going to be that bad.
John Rahm's comment was you can leave your driver in the clubhouse.
You can.
You're going to get the rolls. It's that firm. I agree with you. I think I think DeChambeau is not leaving the driver in the clubhouse. I don't think a lot of those big hitters are. Rory won't, you know, but Rahm the same, who's also a big hitter, but he's like, you don't even need a driver on this. It's so firm, you're going to get an extra 100 yards.
It's almost going to be like Tiger when he won, what was it, St. Andrews 1 year with one drive in four rounds?
Absolutely. They say they could get some wind to kick up on Saturday and Sunday. Let's see. Actually, for guys like Gino and I, we hope. We want to see it a little bit more of a challenge for some of these guys.
Yeah. Like I said, you don't want to see these tournaments at 10 under par winning or 12 under par, you know? So who are some of the favorites you like, Darren?
You know, well, Darryl Boone coming off the Scottish Open, but anyway, why don't you give us the favorites first?
So only two golfers right now for top 10 are negative odds. Scottie Scheffler at -134 and Rory at -106. Everybody else is plus. And the two pluses right off the top are Matt Fitzpatrick at +158, Tommy Fleetwood at +158. Then you get John Rahm at +180, and everybody else is +200 or better at that point.
Where is Shoffley? He's a guy I like on a course like this.
Shoffley is next in line at +210.
Okay. Shoffley's a guy I like on this course. I also think Russell Henley would be a sleeper for me on this course as a guy that can play precision a little bit.
+355, top 10.
Okay. All right. You know, I mean, to me, you know, Scheffler missed the cut, Kev, right? First time in, what, 4 years?
4 years, roughly, yep.
It's unbelievable.
It's funny. He shot even par at the Scottish Open and missed the cut. And to me, I'm looking going, oh, my goodness, what sort of lead is this? The leader is at 9 under after 2 rounds. The cut was at 2 under. To me, that was incredible to have the entire cut line within 7 strokes. I don't think I've ever seen a cut line that close.
No, it's very close. Everybody was playing well.
You know, Scheffler's 9 back after 2 rounds. How many times did he come back and be on the last page of the leaderboard in the fourth
round? Not many, Kev. Not many.
And for him to not even make the cut, 9 strokes back, that was incredible to me. Tom Kim wins it?
Yep, absolutely.
So let's see if he carries any of that momentum over. You know, some of the things you mentioned with some of the odds, Gino. I also am surprised, you know, Scotty, plus 750 to win. He's a favorite, but when's the last time you saw Scotty at plus 750?
Usually it's closer to 240. He's usually
down around 240, 250.
340, that's you know, somewhere in that range.
You know, it almost seems like it might be worth a couple of dollars on Scheffler at plus 750.
So right now, but you know what, Kev? The outright winner right now, Scotty Scheffler is at plus 680 and Rory's at plus 830, and nobody else is less than plus 1750.
Yeah.
Right. So even those two. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at.
Gino's got real time right now. You probably had it before the show, and Gino's got the real time.
Yeah, I mean,
starts in like a few hours.
So
yeah,
right. So nobody else is under plus 1750, but those two to win right now. Yep. So, I mean, you know, plus 680 on Scheffler and plus 830 on Rory. That's still pretty good if you like them, Kev.
Yeah.
As an outright winner, I mean, you know.
You're not going to see odds like that in Scheffler too often.
No.
I mean, listen, if how do you like this one? Scotty Scheffler, top 5, plus 144, Kev.
You don't see that very often. Yeah,
you don't see that very often. I mean, if you're looking for one, this may be a time to hit it.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is going to piss Scheffler off that he missed a cut. I mean, I'm wondering if this is going to keep him focused or if he just doesn't have the game with him because it seems like he's just been a little off. Not a lot, just a little off all year long, basically.
Just enough because he won for the first tournament and hasn't won since.
Yeah.
I mean, the guys I'm looking for that off the beaten path are Russell Henley and Patrick Cantlay, who I think can both play to this style well. Do you guys have upset guys or guys that you think are top 5 worthy or top 10 worthy that people aren't thinking about?
Well, I got three King's Ransom bets for you.
Okay, perfect.
So top 10. This is top 10 finishes.
Yep.
So they're all three of them a parlay. So the first one is Justin Rose and Åberg at plus 1400.
Okay.
Second one is Justin Thomas and Hovland at plus 1800. And then the third one is basically taking three favorites. So it's Rory, Scheffler, and Schauffele, and you get that at plus 950.
That's not bad.
You got it. You got to hit all three of them plus in the top 10, though.
And the Open Championship has always been that one major where, you know, you get the Ben Curtis.
Yeah.
The year that Justin Leonard broke through for the first time.
Sure, you know, McGill.
McGill. You know, you get, what was his name? Vandeveld fell apart. And you get, what's his name? Lowry. You get guys that you don't expect a little bit. This is the one championship where it does happen from time to time.
I mean, Darren, you mentioned Patrick Cantlay and Russell Henley, right?
Yep.
So you could take both of those in a parlay to finish top 10. You get plus 2,200.
Yeah, I'm going to probably take both of those guys in the top 10 because what do I have to lose on something like that?
Right? I mean, you know, when you're doing that, you put $10 down and win 230. I mean, you know. That's the kind of stuff you can actually get away with doing. And even individually, you know, plus 355 on Henley to finish top 10, plus 390 on Cantlay. That's the kind of stuff you can do, you know?
And the other thing to do, if anyone at home that's listening in is a better, is putting is so huge in this. I mean, this is, if your putter's cold, you have no shot at the open. If your putter is hot, you have every chance in the world, and you're putting from fairways at the open. It's a totally different than anything else that we watch here in the States. So you need the guy with the hot putter, and that's what it comes down to. And that's where the question comes in with Scheffler, who has not had that hot putter. And Rory, who's been inconsistent, sometimes looking amazing and other times looking pedestrian. So it leaves it open for the other type players. It's really going to come down to who's hot with the putter, in my opinion, because I think that the firmness of the course is going to even out everything else on the course right now.
And listen, if you ever really want to bet any of this stuff, I mean, some of the bets on here are just outright crazy. I mean, you could bet hole-in-ones and, you know, winning scores and winning margins and bogey-free rounds and, you know, lowest 18-hole scores. And, you know, there's plenty of stuff to bet if you're interested. Kev?
Yeah, I think you look at Morikawa.
Mm-hmm.
He's another guy, you know, fifth in fairways, seventh in greens, third in birdie average. You know, they're firm and fast. He doesn't have to worry about hitting the ball a mile. He's accurate, and that could play very well here.
Plus 270, top 10, Kev.
Tyrrell Hatton. He's been top seven, two of the three majors this year, so he's right there. He's got a chance to be the top 10. You mentioned Fleetwood. I know he's one of the favorites. This is also his hometown, so we'll see if he can finally win his first major in his hometown. And Darren, you and I talked before the show started, Justin Rose.
Absolutely.
28 years ago, was a 17-year-old at Royal Birkdale, finished tied for fourth.
Yep.
Let's see if he can recapture any magic here, because
I agree with that.
When Rosie's on, he's right there.
He can beat anybody. Justin Rose at 45 is still competitive with anybody, anywhere, anytime. I think Shane Lowry also can find a way, because he has great touch for a big guy. You expect him just to be bombing, but he has good touch. And listen, I root for big guys, so I like Lowry. So I hopefully Shane can hang around in this one too.
I'd love to hang around with him after the round for a couple beers.
Whatever happened to that guy Beef? He looked like the guy like 10 years ago.
Oh yeah. What was his name?
Johnston or something like that. Geez. His name was Beef. Everybody called him Beef. Big heavy guy. I love that guy.
Yeah.
You know, that guy would be hanging out with him and Lowry would be a blast.
Yep. And throw John Daly in there.
Of course. John Daly goes without saying. John Daly says, hold my beer.
Hold my beers, plural.
So I'm looking forward to a good one. We'll recap it for you guys next week, but we should get a really nice tournament.
Yep.
Darren, you got some buried treasures for us?
Yeah, I got three baseball and an NHL. I'm going to start with the NHL one because the drafts have been so prevalent. We had the NHL recently, the NBA, and obviously MLB this week. Does anybody remember back in 1993 when the great Alexander Daigh made the comment, I'm glad I was drafted first because no one remembers number two. Number two is Chris Pronger. Anyway, so yeah, good job, Alexander. That aged well. Couple of baseball ones. Mike Trout selected to his 12th All-Star game. It now matches the number of career postseason at-bats he's had. 12 All-Star games, 12 career postseason at-bats.
Wow.
Trivia question for all you nostalgia fans. Who holds the major league record for batting average by a pitcher in a season? It's way back, but does anybody have a guess?
Oh, God. Doyle Alexander.
No, it's actually Walter Johnson. Hit .433 in 1925.
Oh, my God.
He was a career .235 hitter, had 547 hits and 24 homers in 2,324 at-bats. Nolan Ryan, just because it's fun to talk about him. Most no-hitters in history, 7. Most one-hitters in history, 12. Most two-hitters in history, 18. Most three-hitters in history, 31. Guy was just unhittable. Sorry. I mean, I know that, you know, a lot of people, he didn't get the wins. He probably was the Jacob deGrom before Jacob deGrom when he was with the Mets, where he never got wins. But the guy, when he was on, was unhittable. And I'm just going to end it all with a story. You guys know the story of the great Joe Sewell?
No.
Okay. His career started off with tragedy, you know how? In August of 1920, Ray Chapman of the Cleveland Indians was hit in the head by Carl Mays and died the next morning. So they call up a 21-year-old kid named Joe Sewell. He hit 329 down the stretch, and the Indians win the World Series. For the next 14 years, Joe Sewell became the hardest man in history, history of baseball, to be struck out. He fanned a magical 114 times at over 7,000 at-bats, once every 63 at-bats. Not only that, he did it with one bat his entire career. He had a 40-ounce bat that he cared for with a Coke bottle and chewing tobacco. Joe Sewell, who was just called up because of the only time ever where a player died on the field, had one hell of a career, and I didn't really know who he was. So there you go. I know the story, but I didn't know who he was. But Joe Sewell didn't strike out, played with a 40-ounce bat back in the day, and, you know, good stuff. Anyway, those are my treasures. I'm sorry, Kev, what?
So he had how many strikeouts?
According to them, he had a grand total of 114.
Okay, so this year, Kyle Schwarber has 144 on pace for 240. And this guy had 114 in his entire career.
In 7,000 at-bats.
Wow.
You got to remember, the productive out actually meant something up till about 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Yep. And that's what I have for my my treasures. What are we going to do next, G? We talking baseball?
Yeah, so baseball at the All-Star break. Yankees at 54-42, three games behind the Tampa Bay Rays in the AL East. Mets at 40-57, 16 games back of the Braves in the NL East. I don't know. Where do you guys want to start? You know, I'm going to talk a little bit about the AL, the NL, the Yankees,
and Mets. The AL East. You know, I mean, I think the Rays are a huge surprise in one end, and I think that the Blue Jays match it equally the other end, for the Blue Jays being in last place, coming off a World Series Game 7 loss. With their biggest loss, I guess, was Bichette, right? I mean, lost a couple of guys off that team, but they did bring Dylan Cease, who started the All-Star game, so it's not like they really struggled with moves that they made. But wow, the Blue Jays being dead last behind the Orioles now, who are starting to play a little better. The Red Sox playing a lot better. Got really hot down the stretch, beating the Yankees and the Mets. And then the Yankees three back of a Rays team that, you know, you figured it was Junior Caminero and not much more. They got plenty more. The Yankees are going to have to get that catcher you're talking about. The Yankees are going to have to upgrade the bullpen like every other team in baseball that's in a pennant race. And the funniest part is, as much as I ripped them to shreds for most of the season, Ryan McMahon has come on a little bit. He's not good, but at least he's not hitting 180 anymore. He's hitting like 230, 220, so you can almost live with it. The starting pitching, you figure when the Yankees get healthy, they get a little stronger. But the Yankees and Rays should be an interesting battle down the stretch. Kev?
Yeah, I was looking at Tampa Bay. You know, like you said, Caminero, you expected. You know, Diaz and Aranda are both playing very well.
I thought they'd be good. I didn't think they would be great.
Yeah. Chandler Sampson's given some speed, 22 stolen bases. The rest of that lineup, I don't know how they piece it together game to game. But they've got – but that rotation, you know, Nick Martinez, Rasmussen, McClanahan, they're all pitching well. And Brian Baker has had a tremendous year.
Baker's been outstanding. He's been the best closer in the American League by far. And it's not like, it's not like there haven't been other good ones, but he's been outstanding this year.
Yeah. And then, you know, Tampa Bay always, I mean, they're the one team that seems to know how to work with these openers and bulk guys. They've got it down to a science. Nobody else can do it like Tampa Bay does.
And Nick Martinez, kind of a journeyman who started in relief with the Padres and the Reds, comes over here, and all of a sudden he's got it together. He's got it going, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the Rays find a way. We know what the Yankees have to do. The Red Sox got hot. They're going to have to continue to get hot in order to get back into the race. When you guys look at the AL Central, are you surprised in baseball, the White Sox? I mean, I'd say it's them, right? I mean, wow.
You look at, you know, Vargas out of nowhere comes along and does great. You know, Montgomery sort of expected something because he was talented, and Murakami's turned out to be one of the best signings from Japan and since Shohei.
Considering he's been in the IL for the last, you know, 35 days, I mean, it's just unbelievable what he's done.
And then Burke started the season for them. He gets sent down. He comes back up. He's become really, really good. They've gotten good pitching all around, though. Bullpen's been solid for the White Sox. No one saw that. Everyone, I don't know, not everyone. I thought the White Sox were probably maybe 2 years away from being competitive, but they said, screw you, Darren. We're going to be competitive this year right now.
Yeah.
I think Tristan Peters, the leadoff guy, is a great story. You know,
absolutely.
He played the All-Star game last night. 5 years ago, he was playing for the Savannah Bananas. And then he's from Canada, so not much of a college career there up in Canada, and then comes and plays for them, and somebody discovers him, and he gets drafted, bounces around, and finally gets his chance with the White Sox, and is an All-Star.
Listen, it's almost like I want to watch the White Sox a little bit because I want to learn more about these kids. They're young, and they're playing well, and it's fun to watch young teams play well.
And yep. The White Sox are doing this, by the way, with the third most blown saves as a team. They have 19 blown saves as a team.
They don't have a good
– No, they're
they're effective enough. They don't have a closer.
No.
But, you know, they're effective enough that they're somehow hanging on to enough leads and over 500, which is a lot in the American League.
No, absolutely. And the Guardians are right there with them, and you kind of thought the Guardians would be competitive with the Tigers or the Royals, who are showing nothing. The Twins are showing a little bit of spunk, and the Guardians are right there. And the Guardians probably have the most proven talent, I should say, in this division, with probably the best pitching and definitely the best closer of the three teams, where you would think that they would get the opportunity probably to pull away here in the Central. But White Sox can hang on.
I don't think any of us had Kansas City at 21 games under 500 at this point anyway.
No. Very disappointing. Very disappointing. And then we go to the West, where the Rangers have come out of nowhere. And in a division where they just play leapfrog with each other, where the A's led for a while, and then the Mariners took over. Now the Rangers have taken over. The Astros aren't going away. The Angels have shown nothing since an early series against the Yankees. They've showed absolutely nothing. Texas is right there. Now, again, this is a horrible division of baseball right now, but Texas is the team, and the A's have fallen apart from a team that was leading this to, what are they, like 14 games below 500 now, something like that.
Yep.
Kev, why don't you lead us with the NL East, because that's a fun league.
NL East, just as we all expected, the Mets are the worst team in the NL East.
I mean,
we thought it was going to be a three-team dogfight between them, Atlanta, and Philly. So the fact that Atlanta and Philly are up top is no surprise. Philly, ever since they made the move to Manning, he's played unbelievable to get back into it, two back. But, you know, along with the White Sox, they think the other two huge surprise teams are Miami and Washington.
I agree. Miami in particular, because they're only four out. You know, Otto Lopez and leading the league in hitting. And, you know, these guys are getting better pitching than we thought. Alcantara's been healthy. I mean, there's a lot of things happening for Miami that work right now.
Yeah, Alcantara, 130 innings already. ERA's below four. Some of the young guys, Meyer and Perez, have pitched real well.
Meyer's on the fantasy team, so I'm a big fan of Meyer. He's been good for me. I picked him up late April.
You know, Washington's at 48-49, and they lead the majors with 27 blown saves.
Oh, that bullpen's bad.
It's so bad.
The pitching staff.
How good is Wood? How good is he? This kid
is real good.
Oh my God, he's a beast.
Wood is good.
Yep, absolutely.
Wood's good, and they've gotten contributions. I mean, CJ Abrams has really made the jump up this year. He's got 20 home runs. Garcia's been 20 home runs also. Meade's got 17. Plus, so they've got a much deeper lineup.
And they got speed. You know, you got Abrams, but you also have, what's his name, leading the league in steals. I'm blanking. Nunez, is it?
Yep. Nunez.
Yep. So they have, they got speed. They got power. They have no bullpen. This is probably the worst bullpen in baseball. Chicago is competing with them, but I think Washington kind of takes the cake at this point.
Oh, yeah. Washington's horrible.
I think so, too.
And what do the Mets have to do, Kev?
Well, just Washington tied for first in runs scored, 28th out of 30 in runs allowed.
Oh, God.
For a little while, they're lead in runs allowed. So, you know, they've improved. They're only third worst. The Mets, the good things. You know, Thornton had another good start Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That was back-to-back. And then Weaver through the eighth, and then Devin Williams comes in, and with a little help from Lindor's error, blows the lead, and all of a sudden they lose to the Red Sox and get swept. What do they need to do? Stop playing these crappy players. Sunday's lineup. When you've got Eric Wagman hitting fourth, and then you go 6 through 9, Taylor, Torrens, Beatty, and my favorite player, Zach Short. You know, Ronnie Mauricio, when he came back from the injured list, he was up for 12 days from June 25th to July 6th. 12 days, he had 3 starts. Mauricio needs to play every day to see if he can do it or not. It's 3 starts. Vientos goes on the DL. Bichette takes a couple of days off because of some legs. Zach Short starts 3 consecutive games. Why? Why?
There's no real reason.
Why is he on the team? 170 lifetime batting average. Stop.
You got 2 weeks before the trade deadline, Kev, before August 3rd.
Outside of the kids, who's untouchable?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Every bullpen in the majors is a disaster. They need to sell off every piece they have.
They got 2 lefties. People who want them.
You've got 2 lefties, both are free agency after the year. You've got to trade both of them for something.
I mean, are you willing to get rid of Bichette at this point, even though he's 1 year into the deal? Obviously, no one's going to take Soto. Someone would have to be dead, really, really ridiculous to take a Lindor. Are you willing to part with Bichette at this point?
Yeah, because you don't know for sure. He's got an opt-outs every year.
He does have an opt-out. You're right.
So you don't know.
Alvarez, is he someone you're willing to move on from?
For the right package, yeah.
Okay.
Jonah
Tong, is he someone you're willing to throw into a deal?
I'd rather not.
Okay.
I don't want to give up Yon Arms yet.
I'm asking you, that's all.
You know, for the rest of this year, you know, Tong, unless he really starts to turn on here in the second half, he needs a full season AAA. And work through whatever he's working on, you know, try and find these, you know, east-west type moving pitches rather than just north-south. And
get a little courage to come up here and not look blown away when he faces big league talent. That's all.
Yeah. You know, Thornton, I like the fact that he comes up and he's throwing strikes.
Mm-hmm.
82 pitches to get through 7 innings. Freddie Peralta's at 100 pitches to get through 4 1/3.
Freddie's got to go.
Oh, it's brutal to watch because you've got him throwing a 4 1/3, and you've got Christian Scott throwing. And Scott's been pitching well. His only problem is that he runs pitch counts up a lot too. So he's hitting 80, 90 pitches at 4 innings, and he's being pulled. And no first season off Tommy John. You know, you want to be a little careful with the innings and the pitches with him. Yeah. So I'm not so worried. I'm not so upset about Scott. Because you want him to get as many starts in and be careful of the arm. But Peralta's got to be more than a 4 1/3 inning pitcher that he's been for the last month and a half. It's been bad. Devin Williams, the fact that we signed him for 3 years after the debacle with the Yankees and giving up the home run to Alonso.
I didn't see it coming. I thought Devin would be lights out, the best closer in baseball this year.
And Weaver – you know, you'd love to keep him for next year, but we know Jeff Weaver. Or Luke Weaver, I mean.
Yeah, we also know Jeff Weaver. We know Jeff also.
Listen, yep. unless they are the name is escaping me right now, the GM, I'm sorry, Stearns. Unless Stearns is playing hardball on prospects or whatever, there have to be places to send these relievers. Every bullpen in the major leagues is a goddamn disaster. Okay.
Like I said, Weaver, if he's pitching like this, you want him next year, but you're never going to have higher trade value for Luke Weaver than you have right this moment.
Listen, you're not going anywhere with Luke Weaver this year. You could always find a way to get a Luke Weaver type player back next year and pay for him. You have the money.
Yep.
From year to year, bullpen, you can change bullpens with no problem. No. I mean, you know.
We know that.
You gotta change out as many of these guys. You should be able to bring some young players back. They may not be top prospects, but you gotta be able to bring some guys back here for these bullpen guys.
For those lefty arms, you should be able to get top 10 prospects in every organization for it.
I mean, you know.
And that's the goal, is if you can find a way to come back with 3 or 4 top 10 prospects in organizations for a couple of moves, Luke Weaver gets you that. Because people that think that they're all in on it are gonna make those moves, and you're gonna have the opportunity. So you got to take advantage of it. You know, I mean, listen, you're not gonna get anything for some of those starters that haven't done what you want them to do. You're not gonna get as much for Peralta unless you're gonna eat all of his salary.
But, you know what, Aaron? You say that, but you know Lance McCullers was dealt today.
Oh, I get it.
So if he can get dealt.
Well, I'm not saying Peralta can't get dealt. I'm just saying that you're not going to get a top.
Okay.
Right now, unless you're eating the salary, you're not getting a top 10 prospect, is what I'm saying.
His salary was not bad for this year, and he's a free agent.
Yeah, I get it.
Because there's no long-term commitment. So.
There's no long-term commitment, so people will do it. But that's the thing. You have nobody. You're going to have to eat the salary, and then someone's going to have to want to try to re-sign him. I don't think anyone's going to make the move without it. And give you a real prospect.
Yeah, that's it.
Right.
Either you're going to have to eat the salary, or you're not going to get, you know what I mean? So.
And it's not much salary. You're right. But they have to eat it all, I think.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be a big deal for the Mets. Because right now it's about getting better prospects. And listen, say what we want about Stearns, and I think he's horrible. But you look at the Brewers right now in the Central, and he's a major part of how that organization was built. A guy like Mizorowski helps. You know, you get that right guy throwing 102 every pitch. But, you know, he has shown the ability to build the minors, and you sit there watching guys like Benj and Ewing, and you feel pretty good about where the Mets' minor league system can be. It's just
– But then you look at the rest of the numbers down there, and they're bad right now.
They are, I mean
– Up and down.
And then you look at the Dodgers, by the way, who have 11 of the top 100 again, and it's like, how the hell do they keep doing this? How the hell did – I mean, they're playing chess against checkers with everybody else in Major League Baseball with this. They have 11 of the top 100 prospects, and they have the best lineup on the field every day. I don't even know how you do it. I don't even know how you even think about – whatever. I don't want to get into it. Disappointing team to me, the Reds. They're the one that's way out. I've been waiting for this team for 3 years to do something under Francona. They're doing nothing. Pirates and Cards are competitive. The Brewers have been great. The Cubs have been solid. You know, and the West has been the Dodgers, Padres, and Diamondbacks have been mediocre at best. Giants and Rockies are awful.
Yeah.
So now we just want to see what the Mets can get back for their haul, what the Yankees are going to spend their money on, and let's see. Again, I'm hoping that this is kind of the trigger where the Yankees, with that rotation, could start a little New York renaissance with championships again. Let's see what happens. And I with the rotation, I think that could be competitive in any series. G, they need that help.
There's a lot of Twitter stuff about Miller. Yankees, Padres working on a Miller trade.
That'd be amazing. I'd be stunned if they gave up DeVries for Miller and then they give up Miller right away. That would surprise me if I'm in San Diego. But listen, if they get him, great. Move Bednar to the eighth, and all of a sudden I'm saying, I like my bullpen.
Yeah.
I can watch Tim Hill and Paul Blackburn in the fifth and sixth. I'll be a happy guy. And maybe Duvall gets traded over there or cut. Maybe they just send him right to A ball, just outright at the A. Don't even put him in triple A.
It was Warren. It was another pitcher. And it was one of Dominguez or Spencer Jones going for Miller.
I probably wouldn't make that trade if I was the Padres, but. As a Yankee fan, I jump all over it. How about that?
Yeah.
And I do root for both teams, but I am a bigger Yankee fan. So, listen, I hope the deal comes to fruition. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and then there was a couple of lower-level minor leaguers involved or whatever. But that was the piece that started, basically.
The funny part is that, you know, AJ Preller is going to do something because that's what he does.
Well, he, did,
he makes it fun.
He needs to get out of, apparently he needs to get out of the contract with Miller, and he's got, you know, pretty decent bullpen. He needs some pitching. So I don't know. I'm surprised. I would be surprised you trade Mason Miller, but you know, what are you gonna do?
I'm just saying they traded the number 2 prospect in all of baseball, Leo DeVries, last year to get Miller. A year later, you're gonna deal Miller for, you know, Spencer Jones is a nice player, but we see the holes in the swing right now. But we saw that in Judge, and he cleaned that up for the most part in the regular season. We'll see what happens going forward. Reds are my biggest disappointment, and besides the Mets, do you guys have any other disappointments? The Tigers, I'm sorry.
Those are the big ones. Yeah.
For me, it's Kansas City. I thought they were going to turn the corner this year. I thought Witt was going to start. They pulled the fences in. They made a big deal about pulling the fences in the offseason. You know, Perez. Caglione. They made a big deal, and they are horrible right now. So
the funny thing is, I think I picked Detroit, and one of you guys picked Kansas City to win that division. Both of you did.
I had to make the playoffs. I'm not sure if I had to win the division. I know I had to make.
So we're going to be wrong on that. We're going to be wrong in that division. I mean, we're going to be wrong all over the place. I had the Mets making the playoffs. That was smart.
I did not.
Yep, I did. So it'll be interesting. We'll give you an update on where we are with the playoffs at some point soon. But yeah. We still got it's not a full second half yet, but we still have, you know, we have the trade deadline and 2.5 good months of baseball to go. So it should be really exciting.
Yeah. So, Gene, you mentioned the one trade made between Milwaukee and Houston. Houston trade in Lance McCullers Jr. You remember his dad also, ex Yankee, among other teams. And lefty Colton Gordon to the Brewers in exchange for minor league outfielder DH Jaden Fielder. Yes, the son of Prince and the grandson of Cecil. My God, that makes me feel even older than I am.
It's crazy.
What's going on that we're seeing grandsons of major leaguers now? That we watched the whole career. We saw Cecil Fielder's whole career.
The funny part is, if they finish with the same amount of home runs, if this kid matches them with the same number of home runs, that would be
incredible. Once he hits that, if he ever hits that number, he should retire right on the spot.
Oh, the fielders should all go down together. Come on, that'd be great.
That's right.
Good trade. You guys have anything else on baseball?
Nope.
Anything else on anything?
Nope. That's it.
We are Sports Kings from Queens. Darren, Gino, Kevin, talk about the wonderful, wild, and wacky world of sports, a wacky world where we've been glued to a sport that has such a referee problem, it drives us crazy. Please download the podcast anywhere you get a podcast, whether it be an Apple product, Spotify, TuneIn, whatever you like. Please like our stuff on social. Please share it. If you don't like it, share it anyway. But we are going to be posting a lot more over the next couple weeks. And without any further ado, may your sports be with you.